And as we mentioned in the previous program, there is nothing called the pursuit of happiness. Happiness should be right here and now. And we talked about materialism and that people never ever feel satisfied with the greed they have. This carnal soul would always want more and more and more, and you would never be satisfied. And we also talked about the financial issues that you and I might have, and 1 million obstacles that we might try to solve, and that will have its effect on our nerves, on our mentality, on our physical body. Our mental health affects our physical body. One becomes constantly listless as a result of financial insecurity. Some are so full of obstacles and issues about certain particulars that they tired and exhausted everyone and everything about themselves. Such persons, as a matter of principle, are those whose anxiety seeks an outlet in order to surface. And they are constantly after some fresh start, or lamenting and complaining all the time, being negative all the time, constantly giving this poisonous energy to others and to themselves. So when our mental health is not correct, our physical health would not be correct. They are interlinked to each other. Problems of life take a specially fearsome aspect in the evenings for the fatigue resulting from a day's work draws a curtain over the intellect and suppresses its power of rational judgment. At such times, it no longer possesses its usual vigor, whereas the power of imagination is still active, dear brothers and sisters. Finding the arena empty without a rival, and thus the imagination starts to play its role when we sleep, tormenting the person severely about future problems that have not yet arrived. If misgivings and futile apprehensions were to occur to anyone as a result of some small mistake, he should know that something that shouldn't have happened has taken place, and there is no use in getting troubled about it. Moreover, he has no right to complain about what he had to suffer as a result of his own act. Everyone must reap what he has sown. And if he has sowed a bad seed, who is to blame? If one becomes upset by his own mistake and sees its consequences to be much graver than they really are, he would fail to make amends, for that would divide his attention.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
That which is certain, dear brothers and sisters, is that one cannot succeed in solving one's problems with agitation, with anxiety. For agitation does not increase the capacity of one who has made a mistake. And regret and sorrow cannot change what is past. Thus, learn from the past. Use it for today's life. Use it for today's daily activities. But do not go back to the past. And do not think about future problems. Have goals, but do not reflect and try to solve issues that have not yet come. Try to not prejudge things. The only result that one obtains from his or her gloomy thoughts is to make his life gloomy and paralyze his or her activity. When you think like that, when you think negatively, negativity will come to you. When you give this poison to your own body, it will affect you physically and mentally. And also peace of mind is necessary for one who, and also peace of mind is necessary for one to disentangle the issues through reflection and then try not to repeat those mistakes. It is by correct reasoning, dear brothers and sisters, that man can bring a discipline in his moral conduct. Thus, too much concern for the unknown future will not help us. The extent of attention that one directs to the future or the present greatly affects one's spiritual well-being. As you can see, there is a connection between the physical body, the physical health, the mental health, and the spiritual well-being. They are interconnected, as are the different realms that we speak about in Islamic mysticism and Islamic philosophy. The material realm, which is the material body, the barzakhi realm, or the intermediate realm, which has to do with the soul, the nafs, also called the mentality of that person, the mental health, and the noetic realm, or also called the realm of angels or the spirits, which has to do with your spiritual well-being. And those are the things that we will talk about, inshallah ta'ala, in more detail in future programs. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Is all I need.
All I need.
Is all I need.
It's all I need.
Is all I need.
All I need.
Is all I need.
Oh, 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 oh.
Your love is all I need. To be all
I need.
And I know that you see how much you need. You need to me, 'cause your love is all I need. To be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
Hello, and welcome back to The Light. A man-made winter fairyland, that's what visitors may refer to, an ice and snow festival in the Chinese city of Harbin. three giant ox sculptures are on display in this year's edition of the event, as China is celebrating the Year of Ox. The park features hundreds of ice sculptures and castles. The Chili Festival traditionally draws millions of people from around the globe, but it's now receiving a limited number of visitors due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Australia is offering an environmentally friendly kayak tour in Sydney's harbour to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves, and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbour. Each month, about 20 such tours take place. They collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organizers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world, but once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there, so I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Program, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally every year. Experts say that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean.
An annual light festival lights up the Danish capital, Copenhagen, bringing color and life to the city amid the coronavirus pandemic. Architectural lighting, designs and pieces have adorned the city in the winter season, attracting many visitors. Some 30 light installations are located in and around the city, spreading on the bridges, buildings and squares. The organizers have planned two routes, each 3 kilometers long, so visitors can enjoy the festival while practicing social distancing.
A light festival in these dark times is very nice. It's some brightness in your life. You get stimulated through the art.
This is the fourth year the Copenhagen Light Festival is taking place. However, this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, guided tours, talks and pop-up events have been cancelled. Instead, the organizers have prepared an interactive map so visitors can find routes and information about the installations.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of the pandas is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to 5 giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used a clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
The German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
A 70-year-old English grandfather has become the oldest person to row across the Atlantic unassisted. Frank Rothwell broke the world record by completing the 3,000-mile journey in 56 days. Frank rowed from Tenerife in Spain's Canary Islands to Antigua. Such a feat had never been achieved by anyone as old. The septuagenarian sailed across the Atlantic with the aim of raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease and raising £1 million for a UK dementia research charity.
In the UK and other places, I've done a lot of sailing. I've sailed around the world. I've been here 3 or 4 times, sitting in my own yacht. I've sailed around North America to within 900 miles of the North Pole. I've sailed around South America, around Cape Horn. I'm the only man in the world to sail all the way around America in a figure of eight. Nobody in the world has ever done that except me. There's only 10 people in the world, only 10 people ever sailed all the way around America. And I'm number 10, or I was 2 years ago. I've not looked up since.
Rothwell has sailed all over the world, including 3 previous journeys across the Atlantic. In 2017, he also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This shows that to be 70 years young is sometimes far more lively than to be 40 years old.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at the time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. the dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the blessings of the congregational prayers as far as our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah? So, dear listeners, talking about congregational prayers, Salatul Jama'at, this prayers which is done, this act of worship which is done in unison, in unity, together with other Muslims at the same time, in the same place, truly enhances our ubudiyya. It enhances our servitude of Allah, because this congregational prayers has so many spiritual benefits. It has so many worldly benefits, and it has a lot of practical implementations and implications which really do enhance our servitude of Allah, and not just in an individual manner, but in a collective manner as well. Now, we find that in congregational prayers, individuals stand in a single row, coming together to create unity in individuality. This in itself is a very beautiful aspect, where individuals are individually serving Allah, the Exalted, the Mighty, but they have come together and individually, all together, one plus the other, makes a collective which is in servitude of Allah. And so, as we said in previous programs, it is this individual who comes and becomes part of a collective which multiplies the rewards multiple exponential times for this congregational prayers. And so individuals, they stand in a single row. They set aside all distinctions of position, of status.
there is no race or language which differentiates one another. There is no distinction between wealth and job status or financial status or economic background. There is no distinction of gender or nationality or ethnicity or color. All have come equal in the eyes of Allah. All have come equal to stand next to one another. There is no separate place for a wealthy person and no separate place for a poor person. All have come in this congregational prayers to stand in front of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. All have come together, despite where they have come from, to stand in unity, to be as one collective in their servitude and their ubudiyah of Allah in these congregational prayers.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to this segment of the program, Foresight. My name is Muhammad, and today I'm going to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatul Mu'tasimin. Please stay with me. God, O shelter of the shelter seekers, O refuge of the refuge seekers, O deliverer of the perishing. If I seek not refuge in your might, in whom shall I seek refuge? If I seek not shelter in your power, in whom shall I seek shelter? Sins have made me seek asylum in laying hold on the skirts of your pardon. Offenses have compelled me to beg the opening of the doors of your forgiveness. Evildoing has summoned me to dismount in the courtyard of your might. Fear of your vengeance has prompted me to cling to the handhold of your tenderness. It is not right for him who holds fast to your cord to be abandoned, nor proper for him who seeks the sanctuary of your might to be surrendered or disregarded.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. In continuation to what we were saying regarding congregational prayers and how it enhances our servitude of Allah, we just talked about how it's in this congregational prayers that an individual comes, he joins and becomes a collective, and so the individual servitude of Allah turns into this beautiful manifestation of a collective servitude of Allah. We also find, dear friends, in this congregational prayers that there is a purity and sincerity of affection which is created toward fellow human beings. Of course, when we come together and we ask about each other's conditions, we ask about each other's problems, we ask about each other's happiness and sadness, we try to help solve one another's problems, we try to cheer each other up. This truly creates a purity and a sincerity in our affection towards human beings, towards Muslims, towards one another. truly, is this not what Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, the Most Quick to Forgive, the Greatest One who loves every single one of us, is this not what Allah wants for humanity? Allah wants humanity to be affectionate towards one another. And truly, one of the forms of servitude of Allah is when humanity begins to treat each other fairly and with respect and with kindness and with mercy. And one of the ways, again, dear friends, in which we can enhance this form of servitude to Allah, enhance this form of ubudiyyah, is via the congregational prayers, which, as said, helps to increase the purity and the sincerity of the affection towards human beings.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Amin Rastani.
How do I gain closeness to Allah? Let's do three verses of the Quran. The first verse, Surah Yasin, verse 61. وَأَنِ اعْبُدُونِي هَذَا صِرَاطٌ مُسْتَقِيمٌ. Serve me, obey me. This is the Sirat al-Mustaqim. This verse is saying the straight path has to do with servitude. Servitude equals straight path. If you want to get to Allah, you have to be on Sirat al-Mustaqim. So, spirituality has criteria. The criterion is u'buduni, ubudiyya, servitude, nothing else. Next verse, Surah Dhariyat, verse 56. وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسِ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. I created jinn and man only for one purpose. لِيَعْبُدُونَ. This is what it is. Your purpose was to come back to me. إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. Here he's saying عُبُودِيَّة is the purpose. What does that mean? That means عُبُودِيَّة is going to get you there. When you serve Allah, the capacity grows. The more obedience, the more capacity to gain, to receive the light from Him. Third verse, Surah Hujurat, verse 13. يا أيها الناس إنا خلقناكم من ذكر وأنثى وجعلناكم شعوبا وقبائل لتعارفوا إن أكرمكم عند الله أتقاكم. In this verse, Allah says, we created you from male and female. I created you man and woman. I created you different tribes, different branches of peoples, so you get to know each other, you can identify each other. But إِنَّ أَكْرَمَكُمْ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ أَتْقَاكُمْ. The most high of you, أَتْقَاكُمْ, the one who obeys me more, the one who has more taqwa. Taqwa means obedience of Allah. Spirituality equals obedience. What hinders spirituality is disobedience. Very simple. That's our principle.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we've been talking about the blessings and the secrets of congregational prayers in enhancing our servitude of Allah. We talked about how individuals come and they become part of a collective, and it is the individual in the collective which is in servitude of Allah in a most beautiful form of ubudiyyah. We talked about how there's no distinction between race or status, financial position, nationality or gender, ethnicity or language or race or color when it comes to congregational prayers. It is truly a beautiful manifestation of unity without barriers. We also talked about how the congregational prayers increases our purity and sincerity in our affection, our love, our kindness, our mercy, not just towards Muslims, but towards fellow human beings as well. And we talked about how this affection for humanity is one of the forms of servitude of Allah. In this segment, we just talk about a couple of more things. We find that this very congregational prayer, it effaces, it reduces the spirit of selfishness, the spirit of individualism, where everything is self-centered and everything is about me. No, everything is not about me. We must take into consideration each other as well. It also effaces the spirit of isolation and not wanting to be with other people, to be reclusive. No, we must be in society. We must interact with society and with people. And also, it endangers a sense of struggle against arrogance and selfishness, meaning we are able to struggle against vices such as arrogance and selfishness, meaning it is this congregational prayer, this spirit of being part of a whole, which tends to erode our arrogance, and it erodes our selfishness, our self-centeredness. And finally, congregational prayers teaches us unity of expression, unity in direction, unity in objective, and unity in leadership. Very beautiful, vast, and amazing ocean is this thing called congregational prayers. And truly, this vast ocean called congregational prayers has beautiful and spiritual effects upon our servitude of Allah, our ubudiyah of Allah. And as we have said in our previous programs, if for some reason it is difficult for us to go to the masjid, to go to the mosque for our congregational prayers, it is quite easy for us to do these congregational prayers even in our very own homes with our very own families.
Ilahana ma'ada lak malika kun liman malak labbayka qad labbaytu lak.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Aperture.
Every year, hundreds of Americans lose their lives due to violence and shooting. Estimates show that more than 90% of crimes is committed by men. Crimes from mass shooting to murder, armed robbery, and rape. But what is the reason behind this overwhelming amount of violence in American society? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Perhaps to understand the culture of violent masculinity in America, one must look into the myth that being a real man means putting up a false front and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Stay with us as in this episode of Aperture, Tough Guys provides a stunning look at the violence boys and young men routinely receive from virtually every corner of the American culture. From television, movies, video games, advertising, the sports culture, and U.S. political culture. Don't go away.
Were killed.
The deadliest mass shooting in American history.
You were just joining us. Two young men, apparently dressed in long black trench coats, opened fire at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
When it comes to violence, it's almost like there are two Americas.
It's horrific. You can't put it into words.
There's the America that recoils in horror whenever a brutal mass shooting erupts onto our television screens, shocked by the level of destruction and suffering that just a few individuals are capable of visiting upon so many innocent people.
Police say that the gunman opened fire in a theater during a showing of that latest Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises.
And then there's the America that can't seem to get enough of violence as a form of entertainment and ritual, a seemingly endless appetite for ever-intensifying spectacles of all-out brutality and carnage. The question is what sort of relationship, if any, these two Americas have to one another. And if we're serious about answering that question, we need to stop chasing symptoms and take a good look at a truth that's been hiding in plain sight all along. That when we talk about violence in America, whether it's real or imaginary, we're almost always talking about violent masculinity. I'm Jackson Katz, and for more than 25 years, I've worked on both a personal and an institutional level to engage men directly in the effort to prevent men's violence against women and children. The reason I work with and focus on men is simple, because for the most part, violence is a men's issue. The statistics tell the story. 86% of armed robberies are committed by men. 77% of aggravated assaults are committed by men. 87% of stalkers are men. 86% of domestic violence incidents resulting in physical injury are perpetrated by men. 99% of rapes are committed by men. Men commit approximately 90% of murder. And over the past 30 years, 61 of the last 62 mass shootings have been committed by men. But while these numbers are striking, they rarely, if ever, come into play in mainstream discussions about violence.
After every event like this, the questions always are the same. What causes this kind of a shooting? How can this happen? How can they be stopped?
During hours and hours of exhaustive reporting, commentators seem to go out of their way to find gender-neutral ways to talk about this violence.
The shooters in Aurora, the shooters in Newtown,
the Connecticut shooter,
the Aurora shooter,
the alleged shooter, teenage psychopath,
mass murderers,
the suspect,
that kid,
this punk,
this murderer.
The male perpetrators become shooters or murderers or assailants or killers or suspects or psychopaths.
It's kids killing kids in the heart of America.
Violence committed by boys becomes kids killing kids and youth violence.
Here is a revealing and frankly horrifying picture of youth violence in America.
It doesn't seem to matter that girls are kids and youths too, but only commit a fraction of these kinds of crimes. And this baseline failure to acknowledge gender has a big effect when the discussion turns to other supposed causes of violence.
Violence in the entertainment culture.
Bloody games. Gory movies, brutal TV shows.
Call of Duty or Halo.
Mental health issues, the faith issues.
Autism or Asperger's syndrome.
You're blaming the gun.
Their mom and their dad.
Substance abuse.
Mental health, violent games, violent movies.
I want to blame the real culprit.
Alex.
Suicide pills.
Alex.
Mass murder pills.
We hear very little, if anything, about why it is that girls and women also live in a culture saturated with guns and media violence, also suffer from mental illness, also come from dysfunctional families and have substance abuse problems, yet don't commit anywhere near the amount of violence boys and men do. In other cases, the perpetrators disappear altogether.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
You see this a lot in the mainstream discussion about so-called violence against women. The fact that men are responsible for somewhere around 98% of this violence simply evaporates. We hear about women being harassed, abused, assaulted, or raped. Men are nowhere to be found. And the result of all this is that instead of seeing men's violence against women as a men's issue, we see it as a women's issue and focus most of our attention on how to help victims and survivors after the fact. a failure all the more glaring given that mainstream media outlets have no problem at all taking gender seriously when women are the ones doing the violence.
Teenage girls involved in violent fights.
A fight between two young girls breaks out on the playground.
More and more teenage girls are getting involved in violent fights.
When girls and women act out violently, their gender becomes the story. The same way race becomes the story with men of color.
The horrific murder rate in Chicago. Does it have to do with guns or race?
When men of color rape women or shoot people or blow things up, race and culture move to the forefront of the story, crowding out the fact that the vast majority of the perpetrators under consideration, no matter what color they are men. All this is partly a function of how dominant ideologies work linguistically to conceal the power of dominant groups. For example, when we hear the word race in the United States, we tend immediately to think about African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, South Asians. And when we hear the term gender, we tend to think of women. In each case, the dominant group, white people, men, don't get examined. As if white people don't belong to some racial grouping, as if men don't have a gender. In other words, we always focus on the subordinated group and not on the dominant one. And that's one of the ways that the power of dominant groups isn't questioned. By remaining invisible.
There are young men involved in these things. There's a lot of testosterone there.
And on those rare occasions when the subject of men does make its way into mainstream discussions about violence, there's this common refrain that men's violence is all about testosterone and our prehistoric role as hunter-warriors were just programmed to be violent.
What is it about the testosterone of being a young man that makes this come to this gun violence head so often?
Why does it seem that these mass shooters are boys? And not girls.
Really, it goes back to hunter-gatherer days.
Yeah. You hear another version of this in the common refrain, boys will be boys.
Let boys be boys. They want to play rough. Don't try and over-medicate them and, you know, turn them into girls. They're boys.
No one would deny that there are biological factors that sometimes come into play with violence. The problem is when biological arguments lead people to conclude that men are just beasts who are overcome by hormonal urges they can't control, that men are incapable of making moral and ethical decisions, that boys are born hardwired to bully, rape, and murder. But perhaps the most damaging thing this kind of thinking does is that it blinds us to the fundamental role that cultural systems play in all of this.
This is a document signed by six of the major public health organizations saying that the violence in the entertainment, the level that we've attained to today, is causing increased aggressive behavior among some children.
For decades, experts and government officials have been arguing that we need to take a closer look at the relationship between violence in the culture and violence in the real world.
And in the days since the heartbreaking tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, I also tasked the Vice President with leading an effort to come up with a comprehensive set of serious proposals to keep our children safe, including strengthening school safety, improving mental health care, and addressing a culture that too often glorifies guns and violence.
This focus on the culture of violence in America took on new and bipartisan urgency in the wake of Adam Lanza's cold-blooded murder of 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. But unfortunately, it quickly descended into a distracting and false debate between defenders of the gun industry and defenders of the entertainment industry.
There exists in this country, sadly, a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and stows violence against its own people through vicious, violent video games.
On one side, we've had the gun industry blaming movies and video games.
We have blood-soaked films out there, like American Psycho, Natural Born Killers, that are aired like propaganda loops on splatter days. And every single day.
On the other side of the debate, we've had the entertainment industry blaming the NRA and guns.
Can we not do a better job on controlling the weapons of violence that get to the wrong hands?
What both sides have failed to mention is how for years they've been mutually reinforcing parts of the same culture of violence and have profited handsomely from one another. And the reason this matters so much is that while we've been debating whether guns or movies and video games are more to blame for violence, we've missed what the culture teaches boys about what it means to be a man. We often talk about violence being a learned behavior, but it's more to the point to say that it's a taught behavior. And by shifting the focus from learned to taught, we shift the onus of responsibility onto those of us who are teaching our sons what it means to be a man. Since the 1970s, sociologists and other researchers have identified a consistent set of messages the culture sends boys about what it means to be a real man. William Pollack introduced the idea of a boy code in which boys are taught from a very early age to act tough and not show their feelings. Michael Kimmel extended the reach of the boy code into late adolescence and young adulthood, where he describes a guy code in which young men police each other into conformity with dictates about manhood that come with an implicit and sometimes explicit warning. Don't slip up or you risk being unmasked and found out as someone who doesn't measure up. The result is that guys are put into a box that turns out to be the perfect breeding ground for violence. We can't show any emotion except anger. We can't think too much or seem too intellectual. We can't back down when someone disrespects us. We have to show we're tough enough to inflict physical pain and take it in turn. We're supposed to be sexually aggressive with women. Anything short of full-scale emotional shutdown becomes a source of humiliation and shame. And in response, young men learn to adopt what I call the tough guys, the front so many young men put up to shield their vulnerabilities and avoid being ridiculed. But it doesn't just come from their peer groups. It comes from fathers, coaches, and older male role models as well. Eastwood's character, like so many fathers, father figures, coaches, and other men in boys' lives, assumes the role of the director and proceeds to evaluate how well the young man performs his role. It doesn't matter how unnatural, complicated, or ridiculous the role is, boys are expected to learn their lines and master the tough guys, or else risk being shamed as less than a man. A pair of animated films show very clearly how this process is passed down intergenerationally.
Lenny, you see something, you kill it, you eat it, period. Thanks. That's what sharks do. That's a fine tradition. What's the matter with you?
Right here in front of me now, eat this.
In Shark Tale, the father shark makes it clear to his son, who is a vegetarian, that he has no choice but to conform to shark norms and become carnivorous and aggressive.
Frankie, I want you to take Lenny out, show him the ropes.
Oh, come on, Pop.
Son, you're gonna learn how to be a shark, whether you like it or not.
I'm gonna kill you, dragon.
Similarly, in How to Train Your Dragon, the son of a Viking leader runs into problems when he refuses to act violently. And the unwillingness of the boy to use violence causes a crisis in his relationship with his warrior father.
I don't want to fight dragons.
Come on, yes you do.
Who can't even comprehend that his son might not want to follow in his violent footsteps. Qualities like compassion, caring, empathy, intellectual curiosity, fear, vulnerability, even love. Basic human qualities that boys have inside them every bit as much as girls do. Get methodically driven out of them by a sexist culture that labels these things unmanly, feminine, womanly, and teaches boys to avoid them at all costs. And, most importantly, they're taught that real men turn to violence not as a last resort, but as the go-to method of resolving disputes, and also as the primary means of winning respect and establishing masculine credibility.
Andy Pion on KRES Radio, the voice of the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation.
In the groundbreaking film Smoke Signals, one of the first features produced by Native Americans, there's a memorable scene where an older kid tries to teach a younger kid how to be a real-life Hollywood Indian. The scene is funny, but it also shows how the pressure to conform to ideals of violent masculinity cuts across racial, ethnic, and class lines. As the sociologist Richard Majors has pointed out, African-American and other men of color in urban areas often adopt a hyper-masculine, menacing persona he calls the cool pose to signal that they're still men, regardless of what else has been stripped from them. This is also true with Latino men.
Checkmate, bufo.
Who are disproportionately portrayed in Hollywood as gangbangers, Mexican drug lords, and thugs in the barrio. Images that are crude stereotypes, but which nonetheless have become symbols of toughness to some poor and working class Latinos whose manhood has been undermined by class exploitation and ethnic discrimination. And we see the same thing when it comes to Asian masculinity. In American popular culture, Asian men have long been emasculated, stereotyped as ineffectual, desexualized, and unmanly. But since the early 1970s, running counter to this long line of neutered stereotypes is the highly stylized physicality and violence of the martial arts. But young Asian American men don't just have to look to Bruce Lee for cues. Increasingly, we've seen the phenomenon of Asian guys adopting the tough guy street styles of African American and Latino men to establish their masculine credentials. Middle-class white boys may not have a lot of experience with the kind of real-world inner-city conditions that gave rise to the cool pose, but the culture tells them if they take on this black, urban, hard-guy pose, they'll somehow be more real, more of a man. What makes this even more interesting is that a lot of the very guys they see as models of authenticity are themselves projecting an image they picked up from the culture. As the writer Nathan McCall has said, he and some of his African-American male cohorts got some of their ideas of manhood from The Godfather and other gangster films that featured tough, ruthless, white Italian gangsters. And the same kind of thing about Scarface.
It's one of the hottest movies ever made.
This is the all-time greatest movie.
Never seen nothing like that.
I watched this movie 63 times.
It's a comic book. So we have this interesting phenomenon where we have white middle-class males emulating poor urban black males who in turn are getting part of their idea about manhood from gangster films featuring white men who are playing Italian and Cuban-American gangsters.
Now are we made or are we made, man?
The paradox is that the test of being real somehow comes down to how well you live up to a made-up script. And it's a script that's only become increasingly violent over time. The American ideal of the real man owes a lot to the Hollywood Western and the ultimate icon of white American masculinity, John Wayne.
Young fella, if you're looking for trouble, I'll accommodate you.
While other men talked a lot, thought too much, equivocated, and showed emotion, John Wayne made the world bend to his will with just a stare, a few words, his fists, and his guns.
I haven't lost my temper in 40 years, but Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed. And somebody ought to belt you in the mouth, but I won't.
And then there's Hollywood gangster films with cinematic tough guys like James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart.
One move out of you, son, I'll fill your pants for a lead. Get over there.
Men hardened by the world who knew the power of a few clipped words and a few rounds of ammunition. And this equation between toughness, manhood, and violence has continued and in many ways intensified over time. There's no question that over the past few decades, there's been a ratcheting up of what it takes to be considered a real man. Our action heroes. In the 1950s, Superman was the equivalent of an ordinary guy running around in tights and a cape. And today, he's pumped up and ripped. Or Batman. The body of Adam West as Batman in the 1960s is a far cry from the far more imposing Dark Knight of the 21st century. Pro wrestlers' bodies in the 1960s were more flabby. In the 21st century, they're way more sculpted, pumped up, and ripped. And look at toy action figures. If you look at the Star Wars toy figurines that kids played with in the 1970s and contrast them with the Star Wars toy figurines that are being marketed to kids today, you see a dramatic shift. Or the body of G.I. Joe. A study done in the late 1990s found that over the past 50 years, the size of G.I. Joe's biceps in real-life equivalents increased from 12.2 inches in 1964 to 15.2 inches in 1974 to 16.4 inches in 1994 and up to 26.8 inches by 1998. If you wanted a comparison to a real person, the biceps of someone like The Rock are reportedly only about 20 inches. We can see a similar pattern in the changing level of violence itself over time. We've gone from pistols in the 1940s to larger weaponry in the 1970s to the increasing militarization of these weapons in the 80s and 90s to the larger-than-life heavy metal killing machines we have today. We've seen video game violence go from the benign aggressions of Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and Asteroids to the unimaginable and hyper-realistic bloodbaths of today's game.
Get on me!
We've gone from the comparatively orderly sport of boxing to today's number one fighting sport, the street-fighting viciousness of mixed martial arts and cage fighting. Now, there's no doubt we're in the throes of some kind of a crisis in masculinity. But rather than questioning whether it's our inability to move beyond the straitjacket of traditional masculinity that might be the source of this crisis, across the cultural and political landscape, there's been a growing movement to reclaim and reassert traditional manhood.
We need to toughen up and stand up for ourselves and learn to be a lot tougher than yoga is going to teach us to do all by ourselves.
The basic idea is that men are in crisis because women have been waging a full-scale war on traditional manhood.
We've been so emasculated by a so-called women's movement at this point. Even our strongest men are acting girly.
The whole culture is being feminized, in my opinion.
There's a certain emasculation that's happening in our culture.
Part of the problem is we've sort of feminized schools.
I think she's right. It's 100%. We're wussifying America.
Is this the wussification of America?
Yes, this is one more step in the wussification of America.
Is this the latest in the wussification of America?
The result is a narrative that tells men that the best way to respond to change is not to adapt, but to reclaim traditional masculine control and dominance from the forces of feminization.
The founding fathers were men, not wussies. It's the wussification of America that's killing us.
And as it turns out, this is an old pattern in American history. Take the Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouting is one of the few institutions to balance the rather softening effect of our modern way of life.
Aperture.
IRIB English Radio.